judged the winner, I think we must assume he rather liked it. But a century later, time has not been kind to Coubertin's words. Submitted in French and German, these versions of the poem have some tiny scraps of rhythm, form and rhyme, but the English translations read with the same ponderous pomposity as a school sermon. Given the sanctimonious tone of the words, this is perhaps its natural genre. For the most part, it is just an excruciatingly bad exegesis on the model of amateur gentlemanly sport, pioneered in the elite educational and military institutions of the West in the 19th century, where sport built the character and moral framework required to rule empires and their unwashed masses. It was this, and only this group of athletes, and this kind of sport, that was getting the mountain tops of modernity glimmering. Thus, not much can be salvaged of Coubertin's ideological legacy, either from this poem or the world of gentlemanly sport from which it arose. Amateurism and its elite codes have been abandoned by the Olympics, and Coubertin's deeply held belief that the games were primarily a spiritual affair and form of modern religion has been quietly forgotten in the Olympics' transition from a gentleman's club and neo-Hellenic athletic cult to a global bureaucracy that stages a secular, commercialized celebration of a universal humanity. To my ear, just two stanzas of Ode to Sport seem to still speak to us. First, in a quite uncharacteristic celebration of sport's capacity to level social differences, to make talent and ability transparent in an otherwise unjust world, the Baron intoned, "O sport, you are justice, the perfect equity that men strive for in vain in their social institutions rises around you of its own accord." Then, in a language that carries traces of sexual excitement and drug-induced states of ecstasy and alternative consciousness, he praises sport's visceral and intellectual pleasures. "O sport, you are joy! At your behest, flesh dances and eyes smile. Blood runs abundantly through the arteries. Thoughts stretch out on a brighter, clearer horizon." It was not quite Coubertin's intention to create a global stage on which battles for equality and inclusion along the lines of class, ethnicity, gender, disability and sexuality might be fought out. Nor, even in his most ebullient moments, did he imagine the Olympic movement and its games as a place for collective delirium, reflection or laughter. But despite everything, the Olympics continues to offer both. This book is primarily about how Baron de Coubertin and his peculiar vision of the sporting spectacle became the global norm and a global bureaucracy. But along the way, it is the story of the athletes who strove for perfect equity and who made our flesh dance, our eyes smile, and our thinking expand. Chapter 1. This grandiose and salutary task, the reinvention of the Olympic Games. Athens, 1896. Where are all your theatres and marble statues? Where are your Olympic Games? Panagiotis Soutsos, 1833. It is clear that the telegraph, railways, the telephone, the passionate research in science, congresses and exhibitions have done more for peace than any treaty or diplomatic convention. Well, I hope that athletics will do even more. Let us export rowers, runners and fencers. There is the free trade of the future. And on the day it is introduced within the walls of old Europe, the cause of peace will have received a new and mighty stay. This is enough to encourage your servant to dream now, to continue and complete, on a basis suited to the conditions of modern life, this grandiose and salutary task, namely, the restoration of the Olympic Games.